Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Hey, folks out there in broadcast land. Broadcast land, podcast land, wherever and whenever you're listening, spring is almost here. It's been a horrid winter, at least where I am. But Espigan continues to work tirelessly for you. If you visit https://www.espigan.org/knowledge-center, the GI Immunology Masterclass on the 5th of March might be a bit tight there. That's the From Pathogenesis to Clinical Management of EGID, Celiac Disease, and IBD. Then on the 2nd of February, I misspoke on the 2nd of April, extending through the 4th, there's the Nutritional Assessment in Artificially Fed Children with Chronic Intestinal Disorders meeting. And, of course, the Helsinki Annual Meeting, 14th to 17th of May, is coming up. There's a clutch of further opportunities waiting for you starting in early September. And I want particularly to mention, because it might be of interest to some in the podcast audience, will be the Congress on Pediatric Neurogastroenterology and Motility to be held in Amsterdam on the 11th, extending through the 13th. That's not yet in the Espigan calendar. Maybe it will be by the time you look at it. We are here for JPGN Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann. Dr. Jake Mann is just back, he tells me, from a 100-mile run. He specifies it's actually a 101-mile run, but who's counting? This is something called the arc of attrition. 100-mile run. Imagine that, and all that completed within 29 hours. 29 hours of what I think they call a punishing experience. And maybe Jake will tell us exactly what he's being punished for. Jake, your choices for discussion today. We have Malihi et al. From JPGN, the change of alanine immunotransferase distributions among U.S. youths in NHANES 1988 to 2020, and from Nature Communications by Portlock et al., writing from institutions that are all around the world, interconnected pathways link fecal microbiota, plasma lipids, and brain activity to childhood malnutrition-related cognition. Jake, if you're capable of speech, I know that I haven't given you an opportunity quite yet, but if after that 100-mile run you are capable of speech, tell us why you picked these two.
Well, I thought that really we should share in our suffering and analysis of correlation analyses, and that's really why I picked the microbiota malnutrition paper. The other paper I thought really was a good opportunity to discuss what is normal.
Well, in asking me, you've come to the wrong person. I have been AB normal and proud of it for decades now. What is NHANES? Let's start with that. That's the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which in USA residents collects demographic, socioeconomic, dietary, and health-related data together with findings on physical examination and results of clinical laboratory studies. So 15,000 determinations of ALT, alanine aminotransferase, in serum over 30 years. Oof. ALT values, I suppose, are useful in tracking, among other things, metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease. And if you have ALT value shifts that are population-wide, well, you might be able to correlate those with public health interventions. Reduction in how much the kids are drinking, reduction in how much high fructose sweetener they're ingesting. Or it might point out some subpopulations in which diet changes aren't working. What is your take on that?
Well, the NHANES, or maybe NANES, depends if it's a silent H or not, study is really one of the gold standard high quality epidemiological studies that there is out there, and certainly is one of the best studies for longitudinal reassessment of teenage children or young adults that has been running for a very long time. And here we've got data going back to the year I was born, measuring ALT. And in this paper mostly discusses steatotic liver disease, MASLD. And then if you have an ALT and a measure of BMI, then at a population level, that is probably a pretty good estimate or starting estimate for what is going on population-wide in terms of steatotic liver disease, particularly when we're talking about adolescents, where, of course, there will be a degree of alcohol-induced steatosis and steatotic liver disease, but it probably hasn't got such a major impact as it would in an adult population. So the data that has come out of NHANES has been really very interesting. There are other papers where they've looked at transient elastography, FibroScan values, but this paper focuses on the shift in ALT score median and its distribution over, well, a 32-year period. And their kind of key take-home message was that median ALT peaked around, well, it was the 2005 to 2010 period with a mean peak of ALT of 17.8. And in the most recent tranche of 2017 to 2020, the median ALT came down to 14.0. And their conclusion was, or the bottom line they inferred, was that this means that population level interventions have been overall beneficial for reducing the risk of steatotic liver disease or the impact of steatotic liver disease in young adults.
The impact of steatotic liver disease as reflected in ALT values. Yet, don't they also write that the incidence of MASLD did not fall?
Yeah, exactly. So this is where I start. The data is quite clear in terms of, you know, you look at the number of individuals and the number of data points, it is reasonably convincing. I can't really see how statistical magic could have made this data any other way. But if we go back to their table one, the baseline characteristics of the population, the proportion of adolescents with obesity has increased steadily across the entire study period. So even from 2005 to 2020, it went from 19%, 21%, 21.5%. And of course, BMI is not a perfect marker of insulin resistance, but at a population level, it's very good.
Jake, is this study then telling us that so we have to make a few further inferences? We have to say that obesity, BMI, is a tracker for MASLD. That's an open question, isn't it? But we then have to infer that ALT values don't track MASLD or don't track obesity. Is one of the conclusions to be drawn from here that ALT values as a tracker for MASLD are overrated?
There's several assumptions that are needed to reach this conclusion, isn't there? I think that at a population level, BMI and obesity rates tracking prevalence of steatotic liver disease is a reasonable conclusion. May not be true at an individual level, but at a population level, I think that's a reasonable conclusion. In children, ALT is a better marker of steatotic liver disease severity than it is in adults. Whilst it's not perfect by any means, across multiple series, consistently higher ALT is associated with higher proportion of liver fat on MRI or higher histological grade of steatosis. So again, that probably can be assumed to be accurate. The bit that, you know, for their conclusion to have worked, therefore, there would have to be a population intervention that dissociated the prevalence of obesity with the inferred severity or prevalence of steatotic liver disease as determined by elevated ALT. And of course, that is possible, but I think that you may need more evidence to support that conclusion.
Where do we go from here?
Well, I guess this is reflecting my lack of knowledge about the population level interventions that they have discussed. I guess I would have liked a perhaps more detailed analysis of the actual, for example, consumption of high fructose corn syrup, and then whether it's possible to do some form of mediation analysis and track, I don't know if that data exists, but, you know, track, for example, the amount of fructose consumption across the country, and then does the ALT change mirror that? And it would also be nice if you're able to zoom in on an individual population, perhaps with much higher granularity data, and then within that population demonstrate, yes, actually obesity overall has stayed stable, but rates of insulin resistance have subtly come down, and that is why ALT's come down despite obesity still going up.
Ooh. Well, I'll let you think about what sort of anecdote you'd like to share from that 100-mile run, because I know that our listeners are fascinated by the idea of undertaking such a project. And in the meantime, I'll try to summarize the article from Nature Communications. We all, I think, believe that malnutrition in childhood is associated with subnormal intelligence in those who survive. How do we get from one to the other? What are the mechanistic links between these observations? The kid didn't get enough calories. The kid's not quite bright. Well, enterobiome, stool composition, plasma lipid profiles, and evidence for impaired brain growth, development, and function were assessed in two cohorts of Bangladeshi infants between 11 and 13 months. 75 of them were well-nourished. 159 had moderate acute malnutrition. The findings, in summary, are that the enterobiome of infants with moderate acute malnutrition was less diverse than that of well-nourished infants. There were more oral flora in the malnourished infants than in the well-nourished infants' stools, although stool composition, as opposed to stool population, did not differ significantly between the cohorts. Plasma lipids, they looked at 792 of those beasts, and they found differences in 40 of them, some higher in malnourished infants and some lower. But circulating odd-chain fatty acids and ceramides in particular were depleted in malnutrition. There also were abnormalities on resting electroencephalography, decreases in certain wave patterns that are associated with concentration and alertness in the malnourished infants. And when being assessed in terms of behavior, interactions, brightness, they lagged behind well-nourished infants. Bacteroides fragilis abundance in particular was decreased in the malnourished infants, and that's a bug that synthesizes several lipids important in nervous system growth and development, which happened to be depleted in malnourished infants. They don't have the animal models up and running yet, but the association is suggestive. Have I more or less put that together correctly?
I think so. This study is broadly aiming to try and understand what some of the secondary effects of acute malnutrition. And I think whilst it is easy to jump in and say, this study is a whole bundle of associations with no true causal data comparing two very different groups of children. I think we first need to acknowledge that doing any form of detailed study in these kids who are sick, often in fragile families, in difficult settings, those sorts of research is very difficult to undertake. So they've recruited 175 children with moderate acute malnutrition and have done detailed analyses. So that in itself is a major contribution. It really goes to trying to address this question of why are the outcomes of acute malnutrition so bad, even if you can reverse the malnutrition. And here they've focused on neurodevelopment, but I know other groups are interested in the rates of infection. So, for example, severe acute malnutrition has got something like a 20% mortality, and that's almost due to sepsis, including late onset. And absolutely, there are probably unsurprisingly changes in the microbiome associated with acute malnutrition. And then some of these are linked to changes in the plasma lipidome, and then some of those lipids have been associated with changes in brain activity, which they also observed in these children. So you have kind of a series of one to the next of causal inferences supported by reasonably robust associative data that doesn't prove it, but makes it likely.
My question now has to be, do you, well, my request would be, I suppose, not my question. My request would be, what if you provided calories to the moderately, acutely malnourished infants after having demonstrated that they're not quite right and went back and reassessed them? You've said that even after caloric replenishment, the kids don't grow normally and develop normally, that this may be an irreversible change. Am I inferring correctly?
Whilst I am absolutely not an expert in this field, that is my understanding of a period of really very significant malnutrition has got long-lasting effects, both in terms of growth and brain development. And the concept here really is that there is a hit during a critical phase of neurodevelopment, perhaps a deficiency in a certain fatty acid, which is needed for myelination, and therefore the ability to form certain synaptic connections at one point is impaired, and perhaps even subtly, but that has a knock-on effect. And as you say, you know, the next step would be some form of functional data to prove this. I'm not sure how well a relatively simple animal model would reflect such a complex process, as, of course, you can take an animal model and give it some antibiotics and demonstrate changes in its microbiome or even more specific manipulations. But whether that really reflects neurodevelopment in an infant is unclear. From a therapeutic perspective, the question is, well, alongside giving protocoled basically refeeding of these kids, whether you would give an additional supplement, some sort of either fatty acid supplement or some sort of probiotic. But then there's concerns about sepsis and or how they would handle the additional supplement lipid load.
So we're not quite to the point of handing out capsules containing Bacteroides fragilis to these infants and making sure they go down the hatch.
Not quite yet. I mean, that would make me pretty anxious that someone was going to get some form of gram-negative sepsis. But I think that whilst we have not been able to demonstrate causality here, and the authors very clearly say that in the final line of their conclusion of their abstract, We need to acknowledge how difficult these sorts of studies can be to do, and they have made a contribution to the literature of that perspective.
My bottom line here would be that the, well, I don't know. My dad used to say to me that all you needed to make a perfect human being was love and calories. And who knows whether these kids are being adequately loved, but they're certainly not getting enough calories, are they? And the easiest intervention across the board would be to make certain that they get enough food. What all of the all so many so many of our attempts to make things better come too late, and I find that very disheartening.
Yeah, that is certainly fair, and it, as these things can happen in waves, and obviously are influenced by natural phenomena as well as political phenomena and instability within certain countries. And then there is even the fact that sometime in some countries, unfortunately, even when there is affected families come to light, there may not be even suitable interventions available. But I know that other people are working very hard on these sorts of things and acknowledge the major global challenge that malnutrition still poses, even though at a global level rates have fallen since the 90s, I believe.
Well, Jake, you've managed to dodge a bullet or dodge my questions as to exactly what went on during this 100-mile run or why in the name of heaven you subjected yourself to it in the first place. But if your legs have recovered, you're going to be heading out again on another such jaunt in the near future?
I don't think that at this time I need to subject myself to that. I always think that whether to undertake a task depends on the relative balance of type 1 to type 2 to type 3 fun, where type 1 fun is where you enjoy an activity in the moment. For example, this podcast.
All right.
Type 2 fun is where you don't necessarily enjoy it at the time, but you look back on like, you know, actually that was pretty good. And for example, if you it's a bit chilly and you hike up a mountain and you get to the top and it's beautiful, that's type 2 fun.
I'm just thinking of the end of my first marriage. You know, it wasn't all that great, but you're looking back and you say there were some good points there. Okay. I'm taking notes furiously here, Jake. What's type 3 fun?
So type 3 fun is where it was neither fun at the time or in retrospect. It merely makes a good story. And
oh, that's algebra classes. All right.
Exactly. And I usually think with these sorts of things, as long as you have some reasonable weighting towards the type 1 or even type 2 end, then that's okay. But this was almost exclusively type 3 fun for a long time. And right now, I'm not in a mindset to subject myself or anyone else to that.
Back to anecdotes from my family, which is why one of my sisters decided to have her fourth child. She said, well, I forgot how much trouble they were. And one of these days you're going to forget how much trouble that run actually was and you're going to set out again. Hey, that's not my problem. Listeners, thank you very much for bearing with us, and we hope that you're having at least some type 1 fun in listening to these podcasts. If you have any feedback on how we can make them better, how we can make them tighter, how we can contribute more to your type 1 fun, pass it along, please. The Education Committee at ESPGHAN will be glad to hear your comments. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks, Alex.